and happy election day. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So many people have said this election is the most contentious in American history, and we thought that this hour of the show on election day, we would look at times that may make us feel that today it's not the most contentious time in American history. What have we learned from other times in history? How do we move forward? One of the most neglected periods is Reconstruction, and we're going to be talking about Reconstruction, the first part of our program, and then we'll be looking at economic woes because, of course, that was front and center in this year's election, particularly with the ascendance of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Our guest will look at the transformation of the American economy in the decades after World War II, how it happened and why the pace didn't last. And then finally, we'll be speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's pretty much a semi-regular on our program, who looks at the election of 1968, which was a wild one. We'll also, we have a really busy hour. We have WPR news reporters in Wausau and Eau Claire who've been keeping an eye on the polls in those areas to see what turnout is, what they'll be looking for in terms of results tonight. So Glenn Moberg will be joining us a little bit later this hour from Wausau and Rich Kramer from Eau Claire. So all of that is coming up. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. Our first guest, though, let's meet her, is Professor Kate Masser. She's an associate professor of history at Northwestern University and is the faculty affiliate of the Department of African American Studies, is author of An Example for All the Land, Emancipation and the Struggle Over Equality in Washington, D.C. Professor Masser, thank you ever so much for being with us. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you with us. This is a part of American history that, you know, there aren't a whole lot of books written about this, and we tend to forget about this. It was such a time of great promise after the Civil War, and it all kind of fell apart. Because we're in a presidential election today, let me ask you, following the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, could we have seen the emergence of a strong, instead of an impeached, or almost out of office, vice president who became president? Would it have been important to have strong national leadership that could guide us through the years after the Civil War?
Well, absolutely. It would have been important, and it was so unfortunate that Lincoln's vice president happened to be Andrew Johnson, who really was not up to the task. But that period required a huge amount of leadership from Washington, just in the process of trying to figure out what to do and how to bring the nation back together and protect the rights of former slaves immediately after the war was over. So it was a monumental task, and unfortunately, Johnson was really not up to it.
Yeah. The guy who's really intrigued me, mainly as a result of that wonderful book, I didn't know much about James Garfield, but I'm going to ask you because you know this period in history. I have heard that if he had been able to become president for a longer period of time and wasn't assassinated, he was pretty enlightened on issues of race, and maybe, just maybe, things would have been different, do you think?
You know, that's hard to say. I think a lot of people like to do counterfactuals on, what could have happened if this person had been able, if Lincoln had lived, is one of the favorite questions. I mean, the way that I think about it, after having thought about it and taught it for quite a while, is what was really necessary if the nation was going to be committed to the protection of fundamental rights of African Americans living in the South was a stronger exertion of federal power for a longer period of time. Mm-hmm. And at that time, that probably would have required a greater use of the army. Even Ulysses S. Grant recognized, as he increasingly pulled the army out of the southern states in the early 1870s, he well knew that he was doing precisely what was not going to accomplish and that he actually also believed in. I mean, a lot of the Republicans of that era really did believe in equal rights for all people, regardless of race. They believed in voting rights for African American men, but they were also up against the problem of how do you enforce that in a region where the white population really didn't want to see that happen.
Yeah. You write about 4 million people of African descent subjugated as slaves in 1861 were by 1870 building churches, schools, civic organizations. Hundreds of thousands of black voters elected congressmen, legislators, and thousands of local officials. It just breaks your heart to know what happened subsequent to that, and why did it happen? You mentioned the army, but there were also people who rose to prominence who said that, you know, Reconstruction was a mistake and gave us a whole different narrative.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really important to recognize both sides of the story. On the one hand, they're incredibly inspiring stories about the values of a really democratic United States that would stand up for equal political rights, for the idea that everyone should be allowed to vote regardless of their stature in society. And there was huge headway made in that period, and I think it's important to remember that, and it's important to remember that those kinds of ideas about equality and justice that we're more familiar with from the civil rights era actually had a much longer history and real attempts were made. But the other side of that story is the strength of the resistance against that more democratic idea of the nation. And, you know, the reality that white Southerners were determined to stop that from happening. And they used a variety of different means, ranging from kind of electoral fraud to outright violence, terrorism, murder. And in a climate now where we have a lot of talk about the question of how clean are our elections, is there voter fraud, is there voter suppression, I think it's really important to think about the ways that voter suppression was used at that time to ensure that people who actually had the right to vote were not permitted to vote. And that's how a lot of, in this case, the Democrats came back into power in the late 19th century South was through voter suppression.
Yeah. The Jim Crow era that prevailed, as you have written, in the South until the 1960s, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, I mean, what they managed to pull off was very powerful. It was they were very determined and really had to go against federal law, against the will of the majority of Americans, more or less at that time, by asserting things like local control, the idea that the state should have the power to determine who gets to vote within the states, the idea that whites know best what's best for the South and that Northerners need to stay out of it. And, you know, again, these are themes that resonate into the present in our politics. So I'm really kind of always on my soapbox about why it's so important to understand Reconstruction and to understand it in its in the way that we understand it now, because as you mentioned before, it's really been shrouded in a lot of myth and misinformation in the past.
Mm-hmm. And not written about widely by historians, and I'm wondering why that's the case. It is a difficult time to read about, but it's also important and it's also fascinating.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you agree with that. I mean, you know, there's some terrific books about Reconstruction, and there are books that do a lot of different kinds of things. There are books about the African American political leaders of the time. There are some really excellent books about the 14th Amendment, actually other amendments as well. There's, of course, Eric Foner's 1988 book, Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, which is kind of the go-to book even more than 20 years later. So I wish I could argue that it was actually a problem of not having books out there. I think more to the point, it's either that the books haven't made it to more popular audiences, or maybe that it is such a difficult period. So we're trying to help remedy that. Sometimes a lot of historians have been writing for popular press about the Reconstruction era and its resonance for today. Mm-hmm. We're in the middle of the 150th anniversary of Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are more familiar with the fact that we just passed the 150th anniversary of the Civil War.
Right.
But this is now the anniversary of Reconstruction, so there are a lot of opportunities to talk about it and try to help people understand kind of what happened and why it still really matters.
Mm-hmm. You've said, Professor Masser, that it's also Reconstruction is complicated to teach. You're a professor of history at Northwestern. Why is it complicated to teach?
Well, there are a lot of different stories going on, and a lot of times people will compare it, let's say, to the Civil War, where it feels like there's more of an established narrative. We know, or at least the conventional wisdom is it had a beginning in April 1861, it ended in April 1865, and there are certain issues, certain kinds of things that get talked about. There's a beginning, middle, and an end, and Reconstruction is a bit more amorphous than that. It doesn't have as clearly defined boundaries. And then there's all this complexity, I think, that a lot of people learn in school, like terms like presidential reconstruction, radical reconstruction, these tight chronologies. Well, what happened in 1865 and then 66 and 67? And I think sometimes people get kind of lose the forest for the trees, right? So that the larger meanings are not conveyed. And what's most exciting about the period to me are the largest questions that it brings up. Not necessarily that minutia, although that's important too, but what are the big questions that the nation was grappling with at that time?
Yeah. Let's take a quick phone call for you. Jim in Rice Lake. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. What I wanted to add is that when you're speaking of the post-Reconstruction period, I think you should look upon it as two periods. One is the presidency of Ulysses S. Grant, and then after Grant, because Grant, despite President Johnson, took the fairness and the 14th Amendment reasonably and fairly towards African Americans. He was also concerned about the inherent mistreatment of Native Americans, and he appointed a Native American who was not legally a citizen to be his first Secretary of Indian Affairs. It's the loss of Grant's administration and economic scandal that is different in our history. And had Grant's leadership been followed, I think Reconstruction would not have the horrible connotations of Jim Crow that it is. Mm. I'd like to hear your professor comment.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, that's an interesting question, and it brings up the question of how significant the election of 1876 was. When Grant decided not to run for re-election, he had served two terms. But I would sort of push back a little bit in the sense that although, and I agree with you that Grant really did believe in equal rights for African Americans, I think his record on Native American policy is a little more ambiguous, but he started to refuse to deploy troops in the South beginning in 1873-74. And it's not because he didn't believe in the rights of African Americans. It was because he was operating in a climate of economic crisis. He was worried about whether Republicans were going to be able to prevail in the midterm election of 1874 and then, of course, 76. And it was becoming increasingly politically untenable to continue to deploy forces the longer the Civil War receded in memory. In other words, the longer 1865 receded in people's memories, there was less tolerance for sending actual soldiers into the South. So I don't know that I would say it was the thing that was most significant was Grant leaving office, more the changing economic times and the kind of real dilemma that white Southern resistance posed for the federal government.
Mm. Move ahead to the 1960s and John F. Kennedy making the decision whether or not to send law enforcement to the South. It's been with us one heck of a long time, hasn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Please, we need to do, because it's Election Day, we're all over the place, but I'd sure love to have you on for an hour sometime and we can talk about Reconstruction. It's long overdue for us, so I appreciate it.
Well, I'd love to do that.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks
so much. Professor Kate Masler, Associate Professor of History at Northwestern University. Author of An Example for All, The Land, Emancipation, and the Struggle Over Equality in Washington, D.C. It's Election Day. We're checking in with WPR reporters all over the state. We go to Wausau next and also invite you, if you're in parts of the state that we're not covering with our reporters, let us know what turnout has been like. I'm particularly interested in the Green Bay area. So if anybody there would like to give us a little ring and let us know what you're seeing in Green Bay, or wherever you happen to be. You've had some interesting experiences as you cast your ballot today. It's a big day. It's a big thing to vote. 800-486-8655 is our number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So we have a couple of people calling in. Stay with us for a moment. Glenn Moberg is here. Glenn is a 42-year veteran of broadcast journalism, has been a reporter, talk show host, news bureau chief for Wisconsin Public Radio and our Wausau Bureau. He is the host of WPR's Regional Route 51. And Glenn, happy Election Day to you.
Happy Election Day to you, Kathleen. Not a moment too soon.
Yeah, I know. Can you believe how long it's been going on? I just can't believe how long. It's a long time. It's a bit too long, I think.
A bit too long and a bit too ugly this year at a national level.
Yeah, it has been. So what's happening in Wausau? Wausau is, how Republican are you in Wausau?
How what? I'm sorry?
Republican? You're more Republican than Democratic?
I think Wausau, the city itself, is pretty split.
Is it?
There's a strong labor tradition in Wausau. When you get out into the rural areas, it's more Republican. But the cities, the municipalities in central Wisconsin, Wausau, Marshfield, Wisconsin Rapids, and Stevens Point all have a pretty strong liberal base with some conservative voters as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I just called all four of the city clerks, and they're all out at the polls right now, so I don't have any up-to-date polling information for you. But I can tell you that late this morning, they were experiencing heavy turnout. So there's a lot of interest in these elections.
Yeah. And what about absentee balloting? Has that been heavy, Glenn?
Yes. Yes, it has.
Yeah. So tonight you'll be looking at, what will you be looking at specifically in Wausau that will give you an indication, not only presidential, but also the Senate race, which is supposed to be pretty darn close, isn't it?
The race between Russ Feingold,
yes,
and Ron Johnson. Yeah, and they've been hitting central Wisconsin pretty hard, both of them. Feingold has made numerous trips to Wausau, and I just covered Ron Johnson with Paul Ryan earlier this week in Mosinee. So that's certainly going to be of interest. Then we have a whole slew of local assembly and state Senate races, some of which are close enough and interesting enough that I'm not sure how they're going to turn out.
Yeah, do you want to highlight a couple of those?
Yeah, let's go to the 12th State Senate. This is Tom Tiffany, the incumbent Republican, who's a very powerful person in Madison and in the North Woods. He's facing a challenge from Democrat Brian Van Stippen, who is a member of the Oneida Tribe. He's also an attorney for the Ho-Chunk Nation. And environmental issues are pretty important up there, including the issue of local control, which might seem a little bit esoteric, but Tiffany helped push through a series of measures which removed the control of county boards over shoreline zoning issues so that they couldn't enact anything more strict than what was coming out of Madison. That's irritated some county board members who are traditionally Republican. They want to be able to control what their lakes are like. So that's an issue. And when you talk to Tiffany, I participated in a debate with him and Van Stippen. He will tell you that when you come down to the ultimate local control, it involves private property owners, and he's looking out for private property rights regardless of what government body he sees threatening them. So that's an interesting race. Environmental issues are also pretty big right now in the 72nd Assembly District, which is in the Golden Sands region of central Wisconsin,
mm-hmm,
where there's a lot of concern over high-capacity wells and trout streams and lakes that have been drying up. It's currently represented by Scott Krug. He's been the representative since 2010, but before that, Marlon Schneider of Wisconsin Rapids represented that area as a Democrat for many, many years. So it's, I'd say, an evenly split Republican and Democratic district. Krug has tried to distance himself from the Republican Party by saying that we need a moratorium on high-capacity wells in the area.
Mm.
It's not enough for the environmentalists who have thrown their weight behind David Gorski, who's a counselor and a drug and alcohol specialist with the Nakusa School District. So that's one that I would be interested in seeing, because it's a race that I really don't know how it's going to turn out.
Hmm. Oh, they're fascinating. Thanks, Glenn, very much. Have a good election night, sir.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks. Glenn Moberg joining us from Wausau and highlighting some interesting Senate races that are going on and assembly races in that part of the state. Linda in Brookfield just voted, I believe, in Brookfield. Hi, Linda. You just voted?
Hi, yes, I did just vote in Brookfield, and one of my neighbors is at the polling station working with the absentee ballots, opening them,
mm-hmm,
and she mentioned that the turnout was much higher than expected and many more absentee than expected, so they actually even had to pull in another worker to help with the absentee.
Wow, that's interesting, and that vote will be interesting to look at all over the country tonight, certainly. Were there a lot of people in Brookfield when you went to the polls, Linda?
No, I chose a time that I know historically is a little bit quieter because I wanted to get in and out, and I was able to do so.
Right. Yeah, it pays to go at a certain time of day. If you've been voting
indeed
for a while, you know when to do that. Thanks, Linda.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us. We are talking about historical times when things were difficult here as we look at how contentious the presidential race particularly has been in this country. Economic angst, certainly a dominant theme in the election. realized by the ascendance of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Mark Levinson is joining us now. He's the author of An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Post-War Boom and the Return of the Ordinary Economy. He looks at what happened after World War II and why things just didn't keep humming along, why things changed pretty dramatically, and whether or not we can return to glory years and to salaries that will allow us to keep up with the pace of living in this country. Mark is the former finance and economics editor at The Economist and is the author of 5 books. Thank you, Mark, very much for joining us this election day. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. So here we are at a time when everybody, and nobody caught on until just recently, it seems, the presidential candidates or people are saying, you know, this is a bad time economically. Everybody's working. They're working hard. We can't keep up. We don't make nearly enough money to have a middle-class kind of life. And yet we could in this country for a little bitty period of time post-World War II. Is it that narrow?
We had a quarter century after World War II, roughly from 1948 to 1973, when economic growth in this country and around the world was stronger than ever before and stronger than it has been since. That's what I label in my book, An Extraordinary Time. And one of the problems we have now is that people have taken that as a benchmark. They think that the economy can always be like that. We can always have extremely low unemployment. We can always have very rapid income growth. We can get rich fast. And the reality is that most of the time economies aren't like that.
Mm-hmm. And you say this makes you kind of pessimistic, all of us, doesn't it? Whoever sits in the Oval Office next year will swiftly find that faster productivity growth, the key to faster economic growth, isn't something that a president can decree. So how will it happen?
Well, that's right. And I wouldn't say that I am pessimistic so much as realistic. I think the economy continues to grow. In normal times, an average economy grows 1.5% to 2% a year. Okay, that's not nothing. That's reasonable. But in the period after World War II, the U.S. economy and many other economies around the world were growing 4 or 5% a year, much, much faster than ever before or since. And so I think we're just getting back to normal. Governments really have little ability to affect this. The main cause of economic growth is productivity growth. Productivity growth comes to the efficiency with which we use labor and resources in our economy. And there's no button for that in the Oval Office. That happens usually because of private sector decisions as well as government investments. And these things happen unpredictably. For example, we spent a lot of money on computing after World War II, and it really wasn't until the 1990s that that started showing up in productivity growth as businesses learned how to make better use of computers in trying to do their daily work.
Mm-hmm.
So these things have unpredictabilities, and they can't just be ordered up.
Hmm. What about what we can do, what a government can do to stimulate economic growth if this can happen? After World War II, we had, you know, GI bills so people can go back to school. We had money available, government money to be able to get housing, a huge explosion in housing and cars and virtually a transformation of everything, people moving to suburbs and people being able to exist on one income in a family. How did all of that happen? Government support in some ways or not?
Oh, government support had a very important role in that. But it was also possible to have very, very marked advances in different areas. For example, we took, in this country and other countries did the same, millions of people who were working on farms, literally by hand, hoeing and walking behind a horse-drawn plow. And we brought them into factories where suddenly they could work with machinery, mm-hmm. capital equipment.
Yeah.
They became much more productive. That's a trick that we can't repeat. We've done that, right? We took a lot of people whose educations ended up at sixth grade, and we made it possible for their kids to graduate high school and even go on to college.
Yeah.
Well, that was terrific, but we've done that, and now we're talking about getting people a little extra training, a little extra education. That's good. It's not a bad thing, but it's not going to have the same effect on productivity as taking someone who's barely literate and helping that person graduate high school.
Mm. So what?
So we had a lot of low-hanging fruit, and we picked a lot of it.
Yeah. I heard this figure on Point this morning, and I thought it was astounding. And so I thought, oh, you're going to be on today. I'll ask you about this. Somebody was saying that we would need an income of like $132,000 or $133,000 right now in order to have any kind of middle class, truly a middle class life. And yet the average income, family income, is like 57 or even less than that in this country. It really struck me. That's a huge number. We need more than double what we're making now in order to be middle class. How in the world do we accomplish that?
Well, first, I think you have to respect the fact that the cost of living varies differently, greatly across the country. If you've got someone who is living in Manhattan or San Francisco,
yeah, that's for sure.
Their cost of buying a house or renting an apartment is totally different from someone who's living in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Okay, there's no relationship here.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are just huge differences in living costs and in personal situations. For example, if you don't have kids, then the fact that college tuition has been going up very rapidly isn't really a concern of yours. If you do have kids, it's a very big deal. So people are in disparate situations depending upon their own circumstances. But that said, it is true that for average people, incomes have not grown much faster than inflation in recent years. We went through a period after World War II where people could actually feel themselves getting better off year by year. They'd never had a car before, and now they had a car.
Yeah.
They'd never had a TV set before, and now they had one that had color. Things like that we don't feel that same sense of improvement now. We don't feel that same sense that things are getting better. And the argument I make in my book is that this really is a contributor to the discontent that we have, because people turn to government and say, make us feel good about the economy like we used to, and government doesn't have any real tricks to do that.
Yeah. How much of the whole downfall, you highlight 1973 and what happened with gas lines and what happened with oil and energy. If we came to terms with energy costs and did something different, something majorly different, could we turn things around a wee bit?
There are a lot of things that we could do that would help out a wee bit. Providing more money for scientific research would help out a wee bit. Okay? Improving worker training would help out a wee bit. But when you're talking about the things that make a huge difference in the short term, think of something like building the interstate highway system. Okay? We were a country where it took a long time to get from one place to another. We put some money into building an expressway system, and places got to be much closer together in short order, okay? Mm-hmm. That contributed enormously to economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
It made the country much more productive, but it's something that we can't do again. And making the existing highway a little bit wider doesn't do the same thing. You can't have that same boom. So the question is, do we have something coming along that will shake things up, that will lead to another great spurt of productivity growth? And for me, the answer is we don't really know. Take a product like artificial intelligence.
All right.
Right now, artificial intelligence really is not used that heavily in business. It's just starting out. Does artificial intelligence make for a huge change in the way business is done? It's possible. Okay, maybe you come back 5 or 10 years from now, and we've got a lot of new products related to artificial intelligence that totally transform the way business is done and lead to a burst of productivity. That's possible. I can't say it won't happen. But that's, in general, the way productivity growth historically has gone. Suddenly something happens. You've got a burst of productivity growth for a period of years, and then it tails off. And that's kind of where we are now.
Hmm. Let's take a couple phone calls for you. Lori in Madison is calling in. Hi, Lori.
Kathleen, Election Day!
Thanks, Lori, to you too.
In a number of different ways. And by the way, I do have to observe, you know, I'll just say I oftentimes find myself voting Democratic, but, you know, in the past, I'll take the example, I wasn't all that enthused about, for example, voting for Gore or for Kerry. You know, I'm a Bernie Sanders type guy.
All right, Lori, let's get to the subject. Lori, let's get to what we're talking about. We don't want to talk about candidates.
Your guest just mentioned the interstate highway because, yeah. I mean, you're talking about the way that there's been income stagnation. Okay, everybody's unhappy, but is the income stagnation due to, I mean, think about the fact that a greater proportion of every dollar that's, let's say, created in this country is going into the hands of fewer people.
All right. What do you say, Mark?
Well, you're right, but it's harder to get everybody's income rising when income overall is rising slowly. One of the great things about the period that we know as the Golden Age, the time after World War II, is that the economy was growing quickly, okay, and everybody could get a share. Everybody could feel better off because there was a lot to spread around. Now we're at a time when the economy is growing relatively slowly, and so people are much more likely to fight for what there is because there's not as much to spread around as there used to be. I think it's changed things, but I would not disagree with the caller.
We go to Cheryl next in Fitchburg. Hi, Cheryl. Cheryl, are you there? Well, I know what Cheryl wanted to ask, which is a good question. What effect has women in the workforce, and this has been a major change in the last century, too, what effect has it had on wages?
Having women come into the workforce was great for productivity, I mean, for great economic growth, and it was good for wages for some groups of people. You had some people who were in occupations where they now had to compete with women, okay? And there's some grumbling about that, okay, because it used to be just a man's thing, and it was easier for a guy to get ahead. Well, now there are more people in there trying to get ahead. And so I think that that's one reason that certain people may be less contented.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mark, I want to thank you so much for being with us. And please, we're doing these short because it's Election Day, short interviews. To us, they're short, 20 minutes. But I hope you'll join us again so we can talk at length about your book.
I'd be delighted to. Enjoy Election Day.
Thank you. And you as well. I love Election Day. Do you love it? I really do. I've always loved Election Day.
I run for cover.
Nobody invited you to a party tonight?
I think tonight I'm probably going to stay at home with the TV set off.
Really? That's amazing. I wish I could follow suit on that, but you're going to be glued to it all hours. Thank you, though, Mark. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you later. Mark Levinson, his book is An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Post-War Boom and the Return of the Ordinary Economy. He is the former finance and economic editor of The Economist and author of a number of books, and we thank him for being with us. We're keeping track of what's going on in various parts of the state with WPR reporters as well this hour, as we did last hour, and we will go to Eau Claire momentarily and find out what's going on in Eau Claire, and then we're going to return and have Julian Zelizer with us. Julian can talk about any election. Give him a year and he can talk about it. But he's written some really important things about 1968. And so we'll talk to him about that. And he'll give his thoughts about this election as well. So all of that's coming up on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rich Kramer is joining us now. Rich is WPR's reporter and regional talk show host of the West Side, stationed in our Eau Claire bureau, and we're going to be talking about what's going on in Eau Claire today. Eau Claire saw some attention with presidential candidates coming to that part of the state. And we have time to take a couple phone calls from you. As you have voted today, what have you seen in the part of the state in which you vote? We'd like to hear from you. Our on-air phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Hello, Rich. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You had a lot of action in Eau Claire. I was surprised Donald Trump came to do Eau Claire last week. I was wondering what he was doing there. You tend to be a Democratic part of the state, don't you?
Well, the city is, but you get outside the city limits, and it becomes pretty red. Trump is actually, he did pretty well in this in western Wisconsin as a whole during the primary.
So uh-huh.
I think that's why they were targeting. Plus, it's a major draw for as far as media is concerned. You know, you'll get stations from La Crosse coming up here and definitely from the Twin Cities. So
right,
can't
right.
buy net.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good place to be. So what are you seeing today, Rich? A lot of absentee voters, heavy turnout? What's the story?
Well, the polling places were busy. And absentee voters, as you've seen statewide, it's pretty high. I'm not sure if we hit any records locally. But at the polling places, everything seemed to be working pretty smoothly. I saw one person that had to be turned away to go get their passport and come back. It was a younger voter.
Mm-hmm.
I also went to the DMV today for two reasons, to update my tabs, but also to see if anyone was getting a last-minute, you know, voting ID.
Oh.
There was one fella that actually followed me from the DMV to the nearest polling place, and he cast his ballot. Said he felt queasy afterwards.
Hmm.
Which was kind of interesting. But he said the process was pretty smooth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and as far as what we're watching, of course, the presidential is on everyone's mind. But we've got three open seats in the Assembly that have been held for Republicans for at least 6 years each. In the primary, there was a dozen candidates for these three seats, and we'll see if they flip at all. I mean, it's the best chance that Democrats have in the region to take seats, but we'll have to see what turns out. Two major school referendums. Chippewa Falls has a referendum for just under $160 million. That would be for a high school and for a new elementary. And in Eau Claire, we're looking at about an $80 million ballot question that was basically a continuing referendum where they'll get an additional $5 million in change each year for the next 15 years.
Hmm. And any indication where any of those are going? Is there...
Not yet.
No.
Yeah, we're going to have to wait until the returns come in. But, of course, people I spoke with the respective school boards and school districts, they're optimistic about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you see a number of signs in Eau Claire, at least, for, the vote yes type signs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Senate race, the U.S. Senate race.
We saw some, we saw Ron Johnson kind of embrace the Trump campaign. It was interesting. I interviewed him 1 week. He was with Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, and Trump's name wasn't mentioned by either of these senators. But then the next week, we see Ron Johnson with Donald Trump in Eau Claire, also with Eric Trump in Hudson.
Right.
They're making their best effort, again, western Wisconsin, outside of the major cities with colleges. It's pretty rural and fairly conservative in general.
Mm-hmm.
So his odds might be good in this region.
Hmm. We'll be looking, Rich.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hope you don't have to stay up too late.
Me too, but I'm hearing from some of the other networks that it's supposed to be an early night, at least for the presidential.
Oh, really? You've heard that?
Yeah, I've read that online, and I saw some folks talking about it on one of the networks, but I think they're referring to all the early ballots and
right.
also just the way the Electoral College is kind of shaping up. So, but we're going to be broadcasting live from WHWC on all of our local Assembly and Senate races. So if you're in the region, tune in.
All right. Thanks, Rich. Thanks for being with us. Rich WPR's reporter, regional talk show host of the West Side, stationed in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Mighty pretty part of the state. Julian Zolliser is here. You can give Julian any election and he can wax eloquently on that election. But we thought we would look at the 1960s and also get a few of his thoughts on the wild race of 2016. He's been with us many times. He's written all kinds of books. He's a wonderful presidential historian. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the author of The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He's written a book about Jimmy Carter, many, many other books, and is a frequent commentator on TV and radio. He has a weekly column on CNN.com. Julian Zolliser, hello. Happy Election Day, sir.
Happy Election Day to you.
Thank God it's finally here, and when in the world are we going to ever shorten this thing?
I think many people feel that way.
Oh,
clearly a lot of people who are tired and also anxious about the outcome.
You wrote an interesting, you're a historian and can cover so many things, but we wanted you to talk about the 1960s and particularly the 1968. We spent the first part of this hour talking about Reconstruction. It's interesting how issues of race find their way still into a lot of conversations in American history. The 60s, boy, talk about a time that was contentious. It's hard to imagine today even being a lot less contentious, I think it is, than it was in the 1960s with Lyndon Johnson and George Wallace and what was going on with the Democrats and riots in the street and the assassinations, and it was one difficult decade.
Yeah, it was. I think today we talk about how heated this campaign has been and how divided the American electorate is, and all that's true. But when you look at 1968, you remember how these elections can turn really into pretty fierce national conversations, national debates, that ultimately are not resolved. And 68 was about Vietnam. It was about civil rights and race relations. It was about what leadership meant in the White House, with many people feeling on the left and right that Lyndon Johnson had been a total failure. Those questions were out there, and it was just very contentious, the actual process of the election.
Mm-hmm. You also reminded us in an Atlantic piece about the report on racism in America, the Kerner Commission, which I hadn't thought about in a long period of time. What was that looking at? When did it become public, and what was the response among politicians to that extensive report?
That's a study that's put together after the riots in the summer of 1967. There's a series of riots that summer in Detroit and Newark. Those are the two most famous ones, although they happen all over in smaller cities as well. They are seen at the time as race riots. They often start after incidents of police attacking or the rumors that the police had unfairly attacked African-American citizens in these communities. And they unfold in some pretty devastating riots in Detroit and Newark. And Lyndon Johnson puts together a commission in 67 to look into what's wrong, what's going on with race relations in the U.S. And in 1968, it will be in March of 1968, the report's finally completed and comes out with a pretty scathing portrait of America, that we have two Americas, a divided country. And the most provocative part of the report, which is with an election approaching, is that institutional white racism is at the heart of the problems that exist in the city. And it's the force behind the riots that took place.
Mm-hmm. And so how did politicians respond to it? And tell me about the importance of George Wallace in all of the response.
Well, the report got a lot of attention. It was in the newspapers. It turns out they release it as a paperback, and it's a best-selling paperback.
Right.
People are talking about it. They're discussing it. Johnson himself is not happy with it. He actually tries to not suppress it, but make sure it doesn't get a lot of attention because he thinks it makes him look bad. He had tried to do all these social initiatives with social welfare legislation and civil rights, and it made it look like he had failed. And so he tries to divert attention from it, but it doesn't work. The press picks up on this. The Washington Post has a headline about a government commission finding white racism, which is the term they actually use, to be behind the problems in the city. So many liberals say, look, this is proof that if we're going to deal with race relations and civil rights, we have to be much more aggressive. We have to look at how institutions in America perpetuate racial division. But conservatives went in a different direction. George Wallace, running as a third-party candidate, you know, used either explicit or implicit racial appeals, warning whites of the dangers of the civil rights movement and radical civil rights activists, while Richard Nixon, who was running as the Republican, made law and order his central theme. And instead of talking about the need to end institutional racism, he talked about the need for more police in the streets
right. And
cracking down on crime and riots.
Mm-hmm. And Hubert Humphrey, you wrote in this same piece, you write, feared the power of the right rather than the Democratic left and kept his distance from liberal grassroots activists.
He does. Humphrey is it's a tragic figure in some ways.
Yeah.
He started his career as a real liberal and a very progressive voice on civil rights in the 1940s. But by 68, he's Lyndon Johnson's person. He is the vice president. He is saddled with a lot of the mistakes of the Johnson administration. And he's very worried in 68 that if he embraces the Kerner Commission too much, if he sides with civil rights activists too aggressively, that he will be tagged by Richard Nixon as someone who is too far left of center, who is associated with radical, quote-unquote, groups of the time. So he's very lukewarm to it. He supports it. He supports a lot of what's in there, but he doesn't really make this a defining issue. And, you know, some people say ultimately undercut some of his own potential appeal.
What do you see in this election or in other issues that we were dealing with in the 1960s in the 2016s or in this particular era? Do you see anything, Jillian?
Well, sure. A lot of the racial issues never were resolved. And so the kinds of questions the Kerner Commission talked about, a lot of which were about policing and race, are front and center today. Mm. And it's not that they came back. It's they never went away. We moved in a direction in 1968 in dealing with issues of race toward the law and order model of Richard Nixon. And I think now the debate, certainly with Black Lives Matter, is that we have to move in a different direction or we keep perpetuating the same problems. A second similarity, but different, is that a lot of the incendiary kind of rhetoric and approach of George Wallace in 68, who was a third-party candidate, but really played on the worst fears and worst feelings and worst hatreds of the electorate, this year made their way into a mainstream candidate with Donald Trump. And I think that's been pretty striking to see a mainstream candidate adopt that kind of approach to dealing with social issues in an appeal to white working class and middle-class workers who feel that they are struggling in the economy.
Yeah. So what happens to that sentiment that has been riled up by a major presidential candidate? If he wins, what happens to it? If he loses, what happens to that sentiment?
Well, it never went away. A lot of what George Wallace talked about and the kinds of feelings he spoke to, I think, remain part of the body politic. I think Donald Trump's candidacy revealed that didn't go away. That's been part of the story of this campaign. I don't think this goes away. I think these were very strong forces in the Republican Party. If Donald Trump is victorious, you know, the Republican Party might be totally remade around some of these ideas and some of this rhetoric. And if he loses, I don't think his supporters and his support will disappear. They are formidable parts of the modern Republican Party. That's why Donald Trump became the nominee. He didn't make them, they made him. So my guess is there'll be continued pressure within the party to respond to some of the feelings and arguments that came out of this campaign.
Interesting, except that he's been such a media figure, such a celebrity from all those reality talk shows, that does he continue to take the mantle if he loses?
I don't think so. I think he seems like someone who, after a campaign of this intensity, would not be up for another if he loses. And one outcome that could happen if he is not the victor is that you see someone else emerge who does Donald Trump in a more polished manner. So in 1964, Barry Goldwater runs as a right-wing Republican. He's far too extreme for the party. He loses in a landslide defeat to Lyndon Johnson. But the ideas and the people he attracted don't go away. And about a decade later, Ronald Reagan emerges. And Reagan does what Goldwater did, but just in more charismatic and polished and a more charming fashion. And I could imagine that happening with someone else to continue with some of what Donald Trump tried to achieve.
Have fun tonight, Jillian.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks. We will. Jillian Zelizer, professor of history, public affairs at Princeton University, author of The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He's written a biography of Jimmy Carter. He's written many other books, and he is a columnist, weekly column on CNN.com. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening, everybody. Please be with us tomorrow. We're going to have full coverage hey, we didn't spend the last year and a half talking about all this for nothing. It all comes to fruition today and tomorrow. We'll be discussing it. You can bet you that we'll do it well. We have a number of guests with us. Craig Gilbert, Sean Johnson, Orrin Cass, Kathleen Dolan, Ari Berman. Just a few of the guests lined up. And that's coming up tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Happy Election Day.